This is Jill Nadeau on the Larry Mueller Show, and we're taking your pet care questions today. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We got some open lines, so call now. Ray in West Bend, you have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had a cat that I took in as a stray. She was only about 1 or 2 years old, and she was very healthy most of her life. But at about 5 years old, she started developing constipation troubles. So the vet recommended Miralax, and I was giving her that regularly for probably at least 5 or 6 years, just like a quarter teaspoon, half a teaspoon mixed in with her moist food every day. And that seemed to solve that issue, but as she got older, like maybe like I said, around 10 or 11 years old, she became started losing weight, and that was really the only symptom I noticed, is that she is getting sunken in on the sides. And I took her in, of course, to get that checked out, and they originally thought pancreatitis. So she was being treated for that. And then eventually that didn't, you know, solve anything, and I had her in for an ultrasound, and they discovered a mass on either her pancreas or liver. And with the fine needle aspiration, they determined it was cancerous. And I was just wondering if there's been any studies on Miralax, and if that, with that length of time, you know, having her take that for over 6 years, if that could have led to the cancer outcome.
Okay, who wants to take that one? Dr. Amy?
I would say I think it's probably unlikely to be related. Of course, we can never say for sure. But the way that the Miralax works as a laxative is that it actually stays in the intestinal tract and it pulls some water in. And that just basically by pulling some water in, that softens the stool so that that pooping is a little easier. And so it isn't really something that's going to be systemically absorbed. And so I think it's unlikely to be a factor. So sorry to hear about the diagnosis. And I know with, you know, between kind of figuring out sort of a mixed set of symptoms and, you know, between thinking it's just pancreatitis, you know, a lot of the more we look for pancreatitis, the more we find it. So that can definitely be kind of confusing that we can diagnose something and then have that, well, maybe that's, you know, part of it, part of what's going on and not. But yeah, there's so much we don't know about, you know, what the triggers are, what the underlying reasons are for pets to get cancer. I think it's pretty unlikely that the Miralax is a significant part of that.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. And sorry about that diagnosis. That's hard. Michael in Custer has a comment. Hi, Michael.
Hello there.
Go right ahead.
Cut the end there about how long cats can survive.
Oh, Michael, you're breaking up there. Oh, I'm sorry. Try calling back. We might be able to get you through. Let's go to Kathy in Oconto. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just want to make a comment that several years ago, my little schnauzer had a malignant tumor removed. And the vet did not think he got all of it, but he could not, remove it all. So he worked with one of the vets down at Madison, who it was a classmate of his, and they put my little guy on an oral chemo treatment, and my little guy got one more year of very good life. And I just wanted to call up and say thank you to you guys down there.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Kathy. It's nice to hear that, isn't it?
That is really nice to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have open lines, so give us a call, 800-642-1234. And again, you can send an email. It's ideas@wpr.org. And we got an email from Justin in Wapaka. He has a 6-year-old plot hound, a lab mix. He has a skin tag, like it's like a pea-sized growth on that bump on the lower cheek where the whiskers come out. He has not had him into the vet, and might it be serious? What do you think?
That is so hard to say without seeing it and examining the architecture of how it's infiltrating the underlying skin. So I would suggest that if you're worried about it, especially if you're seeing signs that it's changing or growing, or just want to have it evaluated to make sure it's not something that could become concerning, having a veterinarian take a look at it to really get a better idea of all of those features. And then sample it if they feel like it's needs to be sampled, I think is going to be the best way to tell you that more definitively.
It's better to go in than worry about it, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, have some peace of mind.
For sure. So the holidays are coming up, and pets are kind of popular gift items. What should people think about before they give a gift to somebody, Dr. Maria?
Let's see. Are we talking about pets as gifts?
Yes.
Okay. That's a great question and something that's like really, really important to think about beforehand. Because a pet is a really long commitment and it's a big lifestyle change to add a pet to your household. So always think about whether the gift recipient is up for this level of commitment. And it's really probably the kind of gift that you decide together rather than something that maybe you have as a surprise just because of that level of commitment that you're signing up for when you adopt a new pet and bring a new family member into the household. There are so many factors to look at as far as is this the time commitment, the financial commitment, is this going to get along with the other pets in my household if I have other pets? Kind of having that as a conversation, getting to know what level of care a pet is going to need before you sign up for it is really important.
Great advice. Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. Jim in Camp Douglas. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. My dog, a yellow lab, 70 pounds, tried to become friends with a skunk. The skunk declined. And now I'm wondering, I got some hydrogen peroxide, some baking soda, and some Dawn dish soap. Is that what I should use?
That is so... Well, I take it the friendship did not last long. You can find some really good de-skunking recipes online that use like tomato juice and things like that to help. But I'll tell you, that is going to linger. It's going to smell for a while, no matter what you do. So online, they have some really good recipes that you can kind of utilize. And then just make sure anytime an animal is skunked, make sure, because oftentimes it's in the face, and so looking for any signs of discharge from the eyes or discomfort in the mouth. And if you see those signs, you should definitely seek veterinary attention. And certainly if there was ever any bites, you would definitely want to seek veterinary attention, since skunks can carry rabies.
Oh, Jim, I'm sorry about that, but good luck trying to get that smell away. Let's go next to Michael in Custer. Hi, Michael.
Hi again. It was exactly 30 years ago this week that we moved out to a home in the country, a heavily wooded area. And at the time, our 9-year-old Siamese cat, indoor cat, got away and disappeared for 1 month.
Oh.
We thought it was lost and gone forever, consumed by coyotes or who knows what else. But it was after Christmas, at least 1 month later, our cat shows up again at the house and was pretty emaciated, but not harmed, looking pretty scraggly, but we took him back in and nursed him back to health. And he was fine. He lived for a long time after that.
Well, great. Thanks for sharing that, Michael. We appreciate that. So the person with the lost cat, you've got some hope. I mean, how many stories have we heard about cats going cross-country to find their owners? So, fingers crossed. Let's go next to Claudia in Gurnee. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, good morning. I need some new ideas. I have a 7-year-old spayed orange tabby in a multiple cat household. Despite several fresh water sources in the home, she just refuses to drink water. This, of course, has caused constipation. She's had impacted bowels that had to be taken care of by a veterinarian. I have given her several enemas all by myself. She doesn't like it. She also does lick concrete possibly several times a day. This is what I'm doing. She gets dry cat food at will, as all cats in my household do.
She has wet cat food at least 3 times a day with several teaspoons of water mixed in. I have tried drops of lactulose that was prescribed by the veterinarian, but I think it's giving her seizures, so I have thrown that away. I have tried mixing vegetable baby food in with her wet cat food. It has helped maybe somewhat, I'm not sure. Lately, she's refusing her second or her fourth bowl of food with water in it. Because she doesn't want that kind. She wants a different kind. So I have to try 4 different kinds until she says, okay, I'll eat that one. Any more ideas that I can do with this cat who does not want to drink?
Oh, Claudia. So, ladies, we have about a minute and a half if you want to try to tackle that one.
So I think that it's a tough one, and especially in a multiple cat household, I might have a hard time convincing you of this. But having her be separated from the dry food, so the dry food is not an option, might help to encourage her to actually consume more of the canned food. If she is a cat that would be amenable to you giving fluids under the skin periodically, you can talk to your veterinarian about that. That would be something that some cats really tolerate quite well, and some cats don't. If she hasn't been worked up for those seizures, I would definitely talk to your veterinarian about that, because if they, they may be something else entirely. So that would really be valuable. Number one, to try to catch a seizure on video and bring that when you bring your cat to the vet so that they can kind of watch exactly what's happening and help you figure that out. And then see if they have any other medication ideas.
Okay. Sounds good. We're talking with Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge from the UW-Wisconsin Health School of Veterinary Medicine. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back after the news. We're talking about pet care with Drs. Amy Nicholson and Maria Verbrugge. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. They are both doctors, practicing veterinarians that see patients through UW Veterinary Care's primary care service, and our instructors and assistant professors and whatever at the University of Wisconsin, very well qualified. What pet questions do you have? Our lines are busy right now, so jot this down, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, and we'll try to get to that, ideas@wpr.org. So let's go right to the phones. We've got Nicole in Eau Claire. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. I have a question about an itchy golden doodle.
Okay.
She has had some seasonal allergy issues, but now it seems to be kind of continuing into, well, December at this point. We've done some prescription medication with her, prednisone to start with, which we didn't like because that made her pee in the house, and she's an 80-pound dog. So that's not good. We did try a second this year with not much luck. So just looking for some ideas besides, you know, an oatmeal bath and just letting her itch, I guess. You know, she's tearing up her feet a little bit and her underside just itching.
Oh, okay. Dr. Maria?
Yeah, that's a very, very common concern. And she's certainly right at, kind of the right breed and the right age to be showing you that she's going to be an allergy puppy. So sorry to hear that the prednisone had the very, very common side effects of increased drinking, increased urination, and causing her to urinate in the house as a result. That's definitely something that we can see, even though prednisone is really effective for settling down some of that inflammation. Skin allergies is something that we're rarely going to come in and, kind of in one visit, we're going to diagnose and figure you out and, okay, this is the plan forever. There is often a lot of kind of trying different things out to see what works for this particular pet and to see what works for you as well. So it's very likely that there are some other anti-itch medications that are that we haven't tried yet. There is an oral one called Apoquel, and there's an injectable one called Cytopoint, both of which are basically just anti-itch medications that can be really effective. But the first thing we have to do is make 100% sure that we really are treating just regular allergies and that we don't have compounding things like food allergy or, you know, fleas, other parasites, and, you know, infections. Secondary skin infections are so common in our itchy allergic pets. So might be time for a trip back. Kind of now that we are in the cold season, we can say, okay, there's not much in the way of, you know, pollens out there. If we're still itchy, there's a reason. And so it could be food allergy, could be dust mite allergy, could be infection. So we've probably got some things ruled out and probably some more work to do. So might just head back and get to know your vet well, because there's a good chance we're going to be doing more visits over the years for her.
Yeah, it's frustrating for both the vets and for the owners, isn't it? Allergies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Nicole. Next, we have Julie in Eagle River. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you for your program. This question's been going around perpetually in my brain. It's about prophylactic flea and tick medicines, both topical and oral, and if there's any evidence that there's a link to cancer there, and which would be the safest route to go.
Okay, thank you, Julie.
Yeah, so I'm not aware of any link between flea and tick medication and the development of cancer. These products are products that have been tested on thousands of dogs before they were ever put to market, and now we kind of test them every day on our pet population, and I haven't heard of a link. Certainly, you know, we see anecdotal reports that have not been kind of presented in an academic forum or in a reputable or repeatable way. And so I think sometimes there's some internet warriors that come out and give a bad name for medications that we know can help prevent, you know, really devastating diseases like Lyme disease or anaplasmosis, which are both tick-borne diseases. And so, you know, certainly there are certain indications that we would not want to use certain tick or flea preventatives, such as if your dog had underlying seizures or predisposition to seizures, then we would steer clear of the oral formulations, but would stick to the topical formulations because of how those drugs work. But otherwise, they are very safe medications to be giving, both oral and topical.
Okay, thanks for bringing that up, Julie. Next up is Anne in Madison. Hi, Anne. What can we help you with?
Oh, hi. could you tell me if there are any suggestions about taking care of a cat that is over needy and also over needing, as in K-N-E-A-D-I-N-G? it's clear that he was taken away from the mother too soon. Licks me a lot.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Anne. I think we got the idea there. Dr. Maria?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's a nice problem to have. You know, it is, you know, that's in one sense, that's why we have our pets, is because they love us and they show us all this affection. And then sometimes it's a bit much. So I definitely get that, and I've had that same experience. As far as the needing with a KN, if it's the, you know, the fact that it's, you know, kind of uncomfortable for you with claws and things like that, you know, definitely making sure that we're getting him used to having his nails trimmed on a regular basis, and maybe even using those plastic nail caps that we can glue on, and that way we're making sure that he's not, you know, poking, you know, damaging your clothes or poking you in the legs as he's sitting on your lap and that kind of thing. And then a lot of times I think it's about giving them another behavior to do. So it's often very hard to train an animal not to do something. but it is easier to train him a different behavior to do. So engaging him in play, so getting some toys and things like that, or just giving him another way to be affectionate, which can take some, you know, some time to get him established with some new behaviors. But think about how you would rather interact with him and see if you can just kind of train a new behavior from him.
Okay, thanks, Ann. We got an email from Pat in Elm Grove. They have a 16-and-a-half-year-old Shih Tzu who gets uveitis. Is that
uveitis?
Uveitis every couple of months. He already is blind from a previous issue. Would you recommend just treating the eye with antibiotics, a salve, or should there be a steroid with the antibiotic also?
So uveitis is a problem within the eye itself. It's not on the surface of the eye. And so whenever we're using a therapy, we just have to be aware of that. The other thing is that uveitis is it's kind of like a lymph node enlargement. And what I mean by that is that it's a reflection of a systemic problem, oftentimes within the body itself. So it can be just a problem within the eyes, but it can also be a sign of something going on more globally within the body. So whenever you're seeing uveitis that's recurring, you know, we obviously want to make the eye comfortable, especially if you already can't see that poor little nugget. We want to make sure his eye is comfortable, but we also want to make sure that that's not giving us a hint or a signal of a red flag somewhere else. And so I would talk to your vet about making sure that nothing else is going on. But perhaps by treating that, you could also be treating the eye more successfully.
Okay, thank you. And before we go back to the phones, I want to make sure we did talk a little bit about those table scraps that are going to be given to our cats and dogs. What should we keep in mind about giving human food to our pets?
Yeah, so I think the main thing to think about is that a lot of times we cook our table or our Thanksgiving meals and our holiday meals with a lot of oils and butter and all these delicious things that make them very tasty for us, but can cause a lot of gastrointestinal upset for dogs and cats that are not used to eating that kind of fatty and delicious food. And so we really want to make sure that they're not having access to that. In addition, there are certainly vegetables and fruits and other types of food that are actually toxic to animals. And so things like onions, grapes, garlics, things like that, yeasted dough, that can cause a lot of problems when ingested. And I think one of the interesting things that I was talking to Dr. Verbrugge about before this is that one of the toxic ingredients in grapes, we're now thinking, because we all know kind of grapes are toxic to dogs, and what we're thinking now is that it may be the tartaric acid, which is also in cream of tartar. And so we've seen some toxicities through the ASPCA poison control with cream of tartar exposure that's very similar to that of grape toxicity. And so cream of tartar is in baking powder, so any kind of uncooked pastries, all those delicious pies, something like that, we want to make sure that we're preventing exposure to our pet friends.
Would it make sense to have some of their favorite treats around and give those instead of the table scraps and things?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, sometimes even for my dogs, I'll use my actual dog food and I'll just get a little bit of the dog food. I know it's nice and nutritious. They don't know the difference.
No.
They're very happy. And so that's one way that I kind of make them feel like they're included in the festivities without having to worry about them having diarrhea later.
Yeah, that makes sense. And give them to your guests too, because you know they like to sneak. Okay, thank you. Linda in Wausau, you are up next. Hi.
Hi. I have a 2-year-old standard poodle, and this is his first exposure to snow. We've had about 5 or 6 inches of snow in our yard for the last week, and he loves digging in the snow. You know, we're by the woods looking for deer poo mostly, I think, is what he's doing. But I've noticed that his nose is getting really dried out, so I don't know if there's something I can put on. I was wondering about, like, maybe some organic coconut oil. Or are there other products, or should we be discouraging the digging in the snow so much?
Well, I don't think I would discourage the digging in the snow because it sure sounds like it's fun for him. And yeah, I don't really know exactly why they're so fascinated by the deer poop, but that's very motivating for them. So I'm sure he's having a great time with that. And that's great to hear that he's enjoying that and staying active in the cold. So good job there. As far as the nose, it can definitely be related to being cold outdoors. It can also be related to just the dry air indoors also, as this time of year, furnace is running and the air is just a lot drier than they're used to. So you can sometimes just see that get better over the course of the winter as they get a little more used to it. But there are skin moisturizers made for dogs that can be really helpful. So I would just look for something that's specifically formulated for dogs. So for example, there's a product called Musher's Secret, I think, that is often used on the foot pads of dogs that are, you know, outdoors and in the snow. That can really help with dry, crusty noses as well. If you're seeing that get worse, again, probably see your vet, because there are other things like immune-mediated type of diseases that can first present as a crusty nose. So don't want to alarm you, but it's just if you see that it's getting worse, think about heading in.
And one thing I'll just add to that is when we're looking for pet products that are okay for the nose or areas that we can lick, just avoid anything with like tea tree oil, since sometimes those are marketed and those can be toxic when ingested.
Okay, thank you for that, and thank you for your question, Linda. We got an email from Peg in Dodgeville. She has a Great Dane who will be 10 in a week, and her legs shake. Her back legs have done this intermittently for a number of years, but as she gets older, it's getting worse, and her front legs are getting trembly also. She doesn't seem to be in any pain, and the vet has felt around her back legs and hips and felt some minor muscle atrophy, but nothing else. They've tried Dazoquin and some CBD products, but they don't seem to have an effect. Any ideas on what this could be, and should they maybe ask the vet to do more testing?
That's such a hard question. First of all, congratulations on having a 10-year-old Great Dane.
Yes.
That is quite an accomplishment. So that shows your dedication over the last 10 years. Trembling can be a sign of so many different things, ranging from kind of older dogs. Sometimes they get weaker. We have a giant breed dog here, so you're putting a lot of weight on these joints over 10 years. That can definitely cause some weakness over time. So it could just be a normal old age thing, but there's a lot of other things that can cause kind of trembliness, ranging from arthritis to a nerve condition of the muscles, or a more general nerve condition. So I think talking to your vet is a really good idea, and just saying, you know, we're trying these supplements to try to help. It's not helping. Is there other things that we could do to try medically or diagnostically to better control this? And sometimes even taking some weight off, because they are such big dogs, can help as well. So there are some harnesses and things like that that I actually had to use in my giant breed dog when he got older, because he got trembly, just to kind of help take some of that weight off. Because when he was 170 pounds, you know, that's a lot of weight when you're 10 years old.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you very much. And let's go to Louie in Oconto. Hi, Louie.
Yes. Before I get to my question, the guy who talked about the baking soda, hydrogen peroxide, has to be fresh. If you don't have a new bottle not open, go and get a couple quarts. And the Dawn breaks down the oil, so he's right on track. Just mix those three together, put it on, leave it on for 20 minutes, and then rinse off and shampoo. It does a very good job.
Okay, you sound experienced, so, Louie.
I had a Springer Spaniel twice, got knocked with the skunk, and it's not fun. So,
no. Okay, what's your question?
Question is on neutering, and I've heard all kinds of different stories. Neutering a dog, does it change their personality? I've heard that it's not going to affect aggression, except if it was like a sexual in nature when there's females involved, versus it actually may make a dog become more fearful without that hormone.
Okay, thanks, Louie. Dr. Maria?
All right, that's a fantastic question. And, you know, I think overall it's something where there are a lot of strong opinions and not nearly as much science to kind of answer the questions that we're asking. So overall, I would say I'm in the camp of neutering is going to affect behaviors that are sexually motivated. So mounting, marking, things like that. It's probably not very related. When we think about aggression, there's so many different types of aggression. You know, there's fear-based aggression, there's resource guarding, so many different things. And so it probably plays a very, very minor role in those. And there's a lot more important factors. So in general, I would say, long story short, probably very minimal effective neutering on those behaviors, and things like training and management are going to be much more important when thinking about aggression in dogs.
So then is there other reasons for neutering your dog?
There definitely are. I think for me, the biggest medical reason is going to be that as dogs age, they're most likely to get benign prostatic hyperplasia. So an enlarged prostate, which can ultimately lead to you know, sometimes infections or cysts or, you know, difficulty urinating, things like that. Behaviorally, the marking and things like that are, you know, kind of unpleasant to live with and often can be trained, you know, trained out as well. But in general, I think those are the big factors in reasons why we recommend neutering.
Okay, thank you. Elizabeth in La Crosse, you're up next. What's your question?
Yeah, I have a 6-year-old female collie, and she's developed a light-colored spot on her nose, and I was just wondering what that could be. And just as a back or a little more information, I'm currently taking a oral cancer drug daily in a pill form, and I'm good. No worries for me. But I was just wondering what could be wrong with that spot on that the dog's nose, which has developed kind of quickly. It's not a bump. It's the disc coloration of the nose.
I think it's probably something that is worth, you know, bringing up the next time you have her in at the vet, or if you notice that it's changing quite rapidly or that it's developing any kind of signs of inflammation, then you might specifically make an appointment to get it looked at. A lot of times depigmentation can be just sort of something that happens and we don't really know why. So if it's, you know, a spot that used to be dark and now is light colored and the skin on the nose otherwise looks okay, it might be something to keep an eye on. But if you're noticing other changes, then I would think more about, you know, could this be infection? Could this be an immune mediated sort of presentation or something like that? So if it's changing, just have her checked out.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Elizabeth. Rick in Milwaukee, you're up next.
Hi there. I've known about onions and chocolate being toxic for dogs, but this is the first time I think I understood you to say garlic. And I give my 4.5-year-old dog little bits of cracker with garlic hummus on it. And I guess I should stop doing that. And how toxic is garlic for dogs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it really depends on the size of the dog and the amount of garlic and all these other factors. But garlic and onions are in the same kind of plant category. And so we do recommend against giving onions and garlic. Certainly we see, you know, small amounts of garlic that tend to be well tolerated. You'll see it in some of your over-the-counter treats and supplements. But I try to, as much as I can, avoid it since it can cause problems in dogs and cats.
Okay, thanks for the question, Rick. Kind of on that same vein, Denison Two Rivers called, but he couldn't stay with us. And he wanted to know if you can feed your pet tartar sauce or mayo.
I would steer clear from both tartar sauce and mayo. The main reason is how fattening they are. So that amount of fat can not only cause gastroenteritis, so just an upset stomach, but it can also cause inflammation of the pancreas, which is a very sensitive organ that job is to digest fat. And because our dogs are so used to eating a controlled meal, that high fat can cause a lot of problems. So I would avoid that.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for those questions. And thank you both for being with us again. Lots of great information. And, you know, just taking away, do not feed your animal scraps from your table on Thursday. We've been talking with Dr. Maria Verbrugge and Dr. Amy Nicholson from the UW-Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. On the show tomorrow, we'll talk with an outdoors woman who's helping other African Americans reconnect with nature. And then we'll take a look at agroforestry. Hope you can join us tomorrow. That's right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.